나서 we have our last guided meditation on awareness of awareness, on shamatha for this retreat. In resting, we're doing our best to rest in the substrate consciousness. We're seeking to rest in a dimension of our existence that precedes our conception in this lifetime and follows after death in this lifetime. That's the claim. It's unequivocal. It's either true or false, but that is absolutely the claim. And so it's really quite extraordinary claim, that the notion that here we are in the midst of being utterly in a world of flux, of transience, of birth, death, decaying, all of that business. Even in the midst of that, we can tap into something that is still impermanent. This is simply the substrate consciousness. It's within samsara. It is impermanent, but only in the sense that it's arising, passing from moment to moment. So that's the subtle and very important meaning of impermanence in Buddhism. Most things that are born die and you just don't see them anymore. I mean, you take out a sledgehammer and start slamming this iPhone. After a while, it's just not an iPhone anymore. But there is something interesting about that, and that is however much you might slam it or drop a nuclear bomb on it, whatever you like, you just can't turn this iPhone into nothing. Basic preservation of mass energy. So you can certainly make it stop being an iPhone, but you can't make it stop existing altogether. That is the stuff of which it's composed. It's exactly what Buddhism says of consciousness. You can transform it in all kinds of ways. The one thing you can't do with it is make it disappear. Just vanish, go poof. So it's an extraordinary claim. Then the question is it true or not? Or is it just a matter, do we simply give it to the philosophers to chew over and debate? Or to theologians just to simply believe about, or Buddhist, what do you call them, scholars, to believe or not believe? Well, it's an interesting point because this substrate consciousness, according to the Buddhist tradition, and multiple ones, Theravada, Dzogchen, Mahayana, this substrate consciousness, subtle continuum of mental consciousness, Bhavanga, there are other occasions when that alone remains. One of these is deep sleep. Now, it's in terms of sheer activation, the javana are not activated, but bear in mind how easy it is to be rousted or awakened from deep sleep. Just somebody can push you really hard and you're out. So there's certainly a pretty explicit level of consciousness there that you can rise from. Nevertheless, in deep dreamless sleep, it said, javana, activities of the mind, or dormant, Bhavanga is what's left over. So that just invites brain studies. And that is because obviously the brain does a lot more than condition consciousness or condition mental processes, memory, perceptions, and so forth. An awful lot is going on besides that. And so here's some really simple studies, and I'm sure a lot of them have already been done. And that is in deep sleep, which parts of the brain are deactivated, what type of EEG is not produced, and likewise for being in a comatose state, that's when you're more deeply in the substrate consciousness, or when you have had general anesthesia, which maybe is the same as comatose, I don't know the exact semantics, but general anesthesia, where you're completely knocked out, right? Like that woman who was given a massive dose of barbiturates before having brain surgery. Well, from the modern perspective, especially when you have general anesthesia, you're totally knocked out, the general assumption is you're simply flat out unconscious, not conscious. I think the assumption is pretty much you don't have any more consciousness than an iPhone. Buddhism says that's just not true. That is, no, there is consciousness, but not coarse consciousness, not the consciousness of the coarse mind. There is, though, a subtle degree of consciousness. Otherwise, you would never come out of anesthesia. You'd never wake up. You'd never become non-comatose. Because you just can't start from zero consciousness and do something to it to make it become positive consciousness. There is no elixir in the universe that can turn something that is absolutely 0 degrees Kelvin on the consciousness level and turn it into something conscious. It ain't going to happen. So, what would be very interesting there would be to compare those states, deep sleep, and it's probably been done, it's so obvious, but deep sleep, comatose, general anesthesia, and then by a process of elimination, you could see which types of brain activity are directly correlated to or necessary for generating coarse mind. But if we take as a working hypothesis that in these states, like general anesthesia, that the brain, of course, is doing all kinds of stuff, but everything it's doing is irrelevant to substrate consciousness. I'm going to be more precise, is irrelevant to, not conjoined with, coarse mind. But the Buddhist hypothesis would be that when you're comatose, for example, whatever's going on in the brain is not necessary for the continuity of subtle consciousness. Not necessary for it. Because that's the big question. And of course, this is not just, if I can speak really loudly and be charismatic, you should believe it. This is just, you know, trying to look at it very objectively. So, when the Buddhists make this claim, that this continuum, the substrate consciousness, the bhavanga, the subtle continuum of mental consciousness carries on from lifetime to lifetime, for a person who's really outside, who doesn't really understand Buddhism at all, they might think, oh, it's just one more attempt of people who just want to be immortal. They just can't stand the notion of annihilation. And so that's not that. Now they go for this one, you know. Well, I think they absolutely miss the point. Because it's like the immortality, the so-called immortality of a person who's having, let's say, in a little tiny microcosm, of a person who's having 5 or 6 dreams per night. Okay, 5 or 6 dreams over the course of the night. Now, occasionally, and this has actually happened in this retreat, a person will go from dream to dream, and in dream number 3, remember dream number 1 and 2. In dream number 6, remember dream number 4. It does happen. It's very rare, but it does happen. It's happened to at least one person here. So you have past life recall, you know, quotation marks, within the sequence of births and deaths, being born into a dream, dying from the dream, slipping back into the substrate consciousness, which is what happens at death, and then being born out of the substrate consciousness, born into a new dream situation, new dream environment, and possibly a new dream persona. You don't always have to be born looking like what you look like right now at the same age and so forth, obviously. Right. So some people occasionally, rarely, will actually, from dream to dream, remember their past dreams. You know, where they might have even been somebody else. Imagine a person in such a dream saying, I used to be somebody else. And everybody else in the same dream saying, you are crazy. They don't remember it, therefore you shouldn't. I mean, this process of, I haven't experienced it, so nobody else has. Boy, does that run through human history like a plague. You know, just this limitation of imagination. But you can see what a paltry type of immortality this is for almost everybody else, who from dream to dream, I mean, so the next dream, you can't even remember the last one. Whatever you learned, whatever experiences you had, you've completely forgotten them, so you can't benefit from them. You don't remember who you were, so that doesn't help. And so it's kind of a weak, paltry, emaciated type of immortality that you're hit with amnesia every single time. This is something, I mean, if you wanted to dream up some real nice story to make you feel immortal, you'd do better than this. And you'd probably say, every day in every way, I'm getting better and better and better, you know, from lifetime to lifetime. And that's how I would design it. You know, if I was designing reincarnation, I'd say, this is your immortality. Just go as far as you can, and then the next time you'll remember who you were, and you'll remember everything you learned in this lifetime, and you'll start, and it'll be like going from first grade to second grade to third grade, and everybody gets better and better and better. That's what I would have done. But I wasn't invited to design the design the universe. I think, why not? I'm a pretty smart guy. But nobody consulted me. So what we got was just one ongoing series, infinite series, it seems, of amnesia, where we forget who we were, we don't learn, whatever we learn we forgot, and all we're carrying are the imprints of our predilections, our behavior, and so forth. And then in that substrate, of course, buried massive amount of memories, but overall, beneath the threshold of consciousness. I hardly remember anything from before I was 5 years old. Hardly anything at all, right? Don't really care, but I can't. So, brain studies. Well, there's one more case. Oh, let's study the brains of people who are deep asleep, comatose, and have general anesthesia, and then chop, chop, let's get a bunch of people achieving shamatha and study their brains to see whether there's any difference in terms of both different parts of the brain that are being activated, that is through fMRI, study that, and then of course EEG, because the Buddhists are saying this would be very parallel, but it's going to be somewhat qualitatively different when you've achieved shamatha, Because yes, you've slipped into the substrate consciousness, but with exceptional luminosity. Does that show up? Now, that's a simple question. Does that show up? General anesthesia, having achieved shamatha, both have slipped into the substrate. One is dull as a doornail, and the other one is bright like a 1,000-watt bulb. You know, brilliant, radiant, luminous. Any difference in brain activity? If there weren't, that would be very interesting. If there were no difference, that would be very interesting, because they are profoundly different experiences. Quasi-non-experience, radiantly luminous, blissful experience. If there was no difference in the brain activity, that would be quite interesting. So that should be studied. Now there's one more case, and that is in the dying process. Your physical senses gradually implode, your higher cognitive faculties implode, you have a white appearance, a red appearance, blackout. Your mind is now, your mind, your particular mind, has now irreversibly dissolved back into substrate consciousness. If you've already achieved shamatha, you have a very good chance of being able to follow that whole continuum of the dissolution of your mind into the substrate consciousness lucidly. Monitor the whole thing, and when you have the blackout period, it's not just going unconscious, you've just re-achieved shamatha. But shamatha has been dished up to you, you know, because your mind now is dissolved and all that's left is shamatha. So that would be very interesting to study. You know? What's going on in the brain then? Because the Buddhist hypothesis might very well be that the brain has not yet gotten flat. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it has, but that's an open question. But then what happens in the dying process, after the blackout? Well, if you've already achieved shamatha, then the blackout won't be so blacked out. You'll be luminously aware of the substrate consciousness and the substrate. If in addition to that, you've had some very profound experience in stage of completion, stage of degeneration, or Dzogchen or Mahamudra, by whatever means, you've really gained some access, some experiential access to Rigpa, clear light awareness. And then it's going to get to get better and better. Number one, now you're going to find you're on this wonderfully slippery slope of watching yourself lose your mind, kiss it goodbye, slip into the substrate consciousness, luminously, you're waiting in this luminous but empty room for a little while, and then that implodes. You get the breakthrough, the texture dished up to you, because your substrate consciousness is going to implode. You will break through. That's dished up. It's a dished up breakthrough. Your substrate consciousness is broken, and it dissolves into clear light of death. That's dished up. All you have to do is die for that to happen. It's not too hard. If you've already ascertained Rigpa, then this is the best thing to look forward to in your whole life. If you've achieved shamatha and you gain access to Rigpa, you kind of just, wow, the best meditation is yet to come. Because everything's going to be dished up. All I have to do is just cruise, like stream entry, right into Rigpa. Watch my mind implode, watch substrate implode, have Rigpa dished up on me, and then just rest in Rigpa. So what happens then when you're resting in the clear light of death? What happens then in the brain? Outwardly, the signs, breathing has stopped, heartbeat totally stopped. No decomposition of the flesh at all. Many cases of reported warmth lingering at the heart. Skin like looking like a very healthy person. Nothing radiant, glowing, but just like really healthy, nice, lively complexion. Days after the heartbeat has stopped, breathing has completely stopped. This has been witnessed many, many times, including by medical doctors in a medical setting. So this is absolutely not superstition or some Tibetan belief. This just happens, and it's happened frequently. Every 2 years or so, I hear one more case, including at least one of my teachers and probably more, Gyanlam Rinpa, about 5 days. Remained in this. Now, the scientists, I was with them in 1992 when we had the wonderful Mind and Life conference called Sleeping, Dreaming, and Dying. And scientists heard all about this, and they were very eager to get an EEG cap on some dying yogi, And the Dalai Lama said, cool, yeah. The Dalai Lama is just, he's looking for total transparency here. He just would like to bring it out into the clear light. That's why he told Losan Denzin, the monk, be candid when you go off to Herb Benson's lab. Be candid. You know, we have our own reason for being private, but now when we're engaging with scientists, be, you know, let it be clear, transparent, luminous. And so the Dalai Lama said, sure, sure. So they left an EG cap, and then for a long while, I think it just basically got outdated, you know, antiquated. And then something like a year ago, I don't know exactly how many months ago, but very recently, or at least, or sometime before then, Richard Davidson and his team there at University of Wisconsin sent a much better EEG cap to Dharamsala, and it was just waiting there for some yogi who had high realization to be willing to put it on and die with an EEG cap on his head. Well, it happened. It's the former head of the Gelugpa tradition, an accomplished yogi, and he was willing to have this on, I'm sure with a lot of encouragement from His Holiness. He put on the EEG cap. It's totally non-invasive. He went into his final samadhi, and he remained there. I don't remember the exact number of days, but it was something like 2 weeks. It was not trivial. It was something like 2 weeks. It was more than a week. I think it was about 2 weeks, and it occurred just within the last year or so. And so for those 2 weeks, no deterioration of the flesh, classic, clear light of death. Tibetans call it tukdam. He was abiding in tukdam, his final meditation, with an EEG cap on. So the simple question, the obvious question is, while this person, now this has been witnessed many times, including in the West, Gyawakamapa died in a Western hospital in Chicago, I believe it was. This was observed there. It's been observed in Nepal. It's been observed numerous times now. And the medical doctors keep on affirming, yeah, what the Tibetans say they can do, they can do, and we have absolutely no explanation for how they can do it. To my mind, that gives me a lot more confidence that Tibetans know, that is really highly accomplished Tibetan lamas, know what happens at death than the Western doctors do. They can do it, and they tell you exactly how they did it, and what it entails, and what significant it is, and the Western doctors look and, yep, sure isn't decomposing. You know, I mean, somebody knows what's going on, and somebody doesn't. You know, so it's just rational. I have much more confidence in people who can actually do it than people who are standing on outside and observing the obvious, which, you know, bunny rabbits can do. But bunny rabbits haven't devised EEG. So what happened? So I wrote Richie Davidson when I heard about this, because I first learned about it when I was teaching in upstate New York, the Namgyel Center. And they were really excited, the monks there. They said, ah, they've proven scientifically that what we've been saying is true. So I wrote to Richie Davidson and said, Richie, I got a simple question for you. When this yogi was sitting with this, you know, for days and days and days with the EEG cap on, was there or was there not any brain activity whatsoever, including in his brainstem? I mean, any. It's a simple question, right? He said, oh, it's too early to say. Scientists are so coy. And we need more data. So let's have another yogi, please. In fact, make it three with a side order of yoginis. <You know? laughs> So he's not saying anything. He said, wait, it's... I thought it was a really... But you know, this is what scientists do. They keep their cards very close to the chest. And then when they publish, da-da-da. So my expectation... And that's all it is. And this expectation can be flat out false, and it can be demonstrably false. My expectation is that there's no EEG. That there's no EEG while this person is abiding for days and days and days with no heartbeat and no breath. I find it really hard to imagine how there could be an EEG. But the fact that I find something hard to imagine doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Right? So... either way, either there's some subtle level, or maybe they'll find, I mean, the Tibetans say flat out no heartbeat. Well, maybe the scientists will find there was a teeny, teeny, teeny bit of heartbeat. These Tibetans say there's absolutely no breathing going on. Maybe the scientists will say, no, teeny, teeny, bit. Maybe they will. What they find is what they find. This is completely transparent, open. What they find is what they find. I just wish they would tell us what they find, but, you know, in their own sweet time. In the meantime, they want another yogi. What the Tibetans say is that when you slip into the blackout, the prana associated with mind, Sokzingi Lung it's called, the prana of the life force, dissolves into the heart chakra. That's what happens when you achieve shamatha. Then when you break through the substrate consciousness and you go into clear light of death, or you're fully healthy and alive and you break through the substrate consciousness and realize rikpa, either case, then these energies, they go from coarse to subtle when they dissolve into the heart chakra, and then they go from subtle to very subtle when they dissolve into the indestructible bindu at the heart. Bindu means an orb, a vital essence kind of orb, orb of energy, bindu. Which means, though, that there's still some connection. There's still some connection between your subtle consciousness, your subtle energy, and this coarse physical body. Because it's located in this physical body, the subtle energy is. It's not over here, it's not outside, it's in there, inside, like the inner sanctum of the heart chakra. It's in there. And as long as that subtle energy, which is indivisible from, no, very subtle energy, indivisible from very subtle mind, as long as they still linger there in the indestructible bindu at the heart chakra, then your body will not decompose. And so in that point, we just don't have a category in modern biological or medical terminology. Is the person dead or alive? We have to say, well, can't say it's alive. There's no breath. I suspect there's no EEG, but we'll find out. There's no psyche. Not alive. But then dead, I mean, dead bodies decompose, so it's not dead. It seems to be right on the cusp. And then as soon as that subtle continuum, very subtle continuum, disengages, then the body, in most cases, decomposes, unless the person achieves rainbow body, in which case that's another story. But otherwise, the body then starts decomposing. So, simple assertion, substrate consciousness, when the mind dissolves into that, as in the case of shamatha, or the blackout phase of the dying process, whatever is happening happening in the brain is not necessary for the perpetuation of that dimension of consciousness. If there's anything in the blackout phase and the dying process that's still going on in the brain, it's no longer relevant to that. It's not relevant to it. So here we are, from the inside out. I think the most truly scientific way to explore this, not the only way, but the most scientific way, the most radically empirical way, of course, is just to tap into it yourself. You know, to tap, know for yourself, is there a substrate consciousness? What's it like from the inside? See it for yourself. And then pad it. As William James suggested, let introspection be first, foremost, and always the primary mode of investigation in the mind, and then pad it with auxiliary studies, then study what is and is not occurring in the brain, and then the facial, the complexion, the warmth, that's in a way that's kind of like behavior. And not really behavior, but it's something that is not just brain activity. So then go ahead, they had heat sensors on the yogi's heart. They checked that. I'm sure they had some sensors to see about subtle respiration. So it wasn't just EEG. So bring in from all three. Let the contemplative study this from a first-person perspective, because that's the most interesting. That's like 99% of what's really going on. Let the brain scientist study what they love to study, brain activity. Let the physiologist, behaviorist, study warmth at the heart and other coarser physiological signs. Bring it all together. And we might then get some real clarity about what has remained overall for humanity a mystery for millennia. What happens at death? Because something happens. And it would be good to know that before it happens, so we can plan accordingly. Just that simple. Let's practice. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states. Calm the mind with mindfulness of breathing. let your eyes be at least partially open. And simply rest without taking anything as an object. Simply maintain a continuity of being present in the present without meditating on anything, but sustaining your flow of mindfulness without distraction and without grasping. Then direct just your mental awareness directly upwards without visualizing anything. Simply direct your attention up into space. While gently sustaining the flow of awareness of awareness. And let your awareness descend to its own place and simply rest in this awareness of awareness with no object apart from that raw experience of being aware. Direct your mental awareness to the right. As if you are seeking to listen to something far, far away. Off to your right, directing the full force of your mental awareness to the greatest distance that your mind can reach. And back to the center. To the left, back to the center. Down into the space below, as far as the mind can reach. back to the center. Let your awareness descend to the heart chakra, and be aware of itself there. Release your awareness into space, sustaining the flow of awareness of awareness. And simply rest. Let your awareness descend to its own place. and simply know itself from moment to moment. Lasso. Within the historical sweep or the panoramic view of Buddhism over the last 2,500 years, we're living right now in an exceptionally interesting time, a time of high drama. The Holocaust perpetrated against Buddhism throughout much of Asia was within my lifetime. Much of it was. Some of it with my parents' lifetime. So massive destruction. And here we are now at the beginning of the 21st century. And there are two very clear currents that are basically, I think, death warrants for Buddhism as a living tradition. The scholars will always have their texts, so no worry. They can always, you know, do philological studies and socioeconomic studies, and that's not going to die. But in terms of a living tradition that actually liberates people, actually purifies their minds, I see two death warrants for Buddhism. And one is it just gets absorbed into modernity. It's almost like it got mortally wounded by the various communist regimes, and then people come in to just basically start dismembering it. So some people with a strong penchant for psychology come in and just throw out any part of Buddhism that doesn't correspond to their psychological assumptions. So there's no liberation, mental afflictions are not mental afflictions, and they basically whack it off. It's like they're dismembering a corpse that isn't even quite dead yet. They just chop off anything that doesn't correspond to their own assumptions, redefine mindfulness, redefine liberation, redefine. Basically now they just have a modified version of Freudian psychoanalysis. So that's one way that it just gets psychologized to death, and all we have is a 251st school of psychotherapy. Well, Buddhism is dead. And now, welcome, you have 251 instead of 250 schools of psychotherapy. That's one way. That's a death warrant. And the other one is also a death warrant, but very different. And that is the death warrant of saying, look, 100 years ago, for example, in Tibet, we had it right, and we don't care where you're from, this is the right way. And teach us all the rituals, teach us as if we are Tibetans, teach us as if we are not even living in the 21st century, teach us as if we're not even Westerner, teach us as if we have no cultural history of our own, and just insist, well, you don't quite look Tibetan, but let's pretend you're Tibetan, and just, you know, insist, this is the pure Dharma, the way we did it in the 19th century. And if it works, then hallelujah. I mean, if we have people nowadays, over the last 40 years, achieving stage regeneration, stage of completion, achieving spontaneous bodhicitta, direct realization of emptiness, rainbow body, then I'd say keep it by the books, hallelujah, keep it like it, right, you know, you're right. Just like in the 19th century, it was really working then, lots of everything I just said, realization of emptiness, bodhicitta, rainbow body, stage regeneration, they had it. There's really good evidence from my perspective. But if the form is the same, but the content's radically different, if people are not achieving shamatha, not achieving bodhicitta, not achieving vipassana, stage regeneration completion, not achieving tutkel, the outer form is the same and the inner content is not there. So we can do all the preliminary practices and three-year retreats here and three-year retreats there and all the rituals and all the outer form and become geshes or kembos and so forth. And all the outer form is the same. The only difference is, where's the juice? And so one may have the pride if we are maintaining our tradition. Yeah, you're maintaining an empty house. The outer form is there, but the house was there to provide liberation, an abode to become enlightened. So if it's working, good. But this is where empiricism comes in. Give the teachings, give the practices, and then keep your eyes open. Are people, for example, developing renunciation? Renunciation is not that mysterious a type of thing. And so if people are meditating, doing massive amounts of discursive meditations, that's one legitimate way of doing it, right? Lamrim is almost entirely discursive. That is absolutely legitimate. But then the question comes, does it work? Or are people just getting depressed and stressed out and loomed and then kind of gloomy and, I'm getting dharmaed out, you know? That's not renunciation. That's just getting loom. That's just getting nervous disorder. And so what works? We know what renunciation is. Does renunciation come more by doing a lot of shamatha or preliminary practices or discursive meditations? How does it happen? But keeping the eyes open. Likewise for bodhicitta, compassion, exchange of self and others. What's working? So I think in this regard, the spirit of empiricism, of being critically, constructively skeptical, pragmatic, that we get from science, give that a massive dose, give it an infusion into Buddhism. Not all the scientific, how do you say, findings, we don't need all of that about geology and so forth and so on, but that spirit of empiricism, pragmatism, infuse it into current Buddhism. So when teachings are given, everybody has their eyes open, the teachers and the students. Are these teachings bringing about the transformations for which they are designed or not? If they're not, then alter them somewhat. Let the form of Buddha Dharma adapt to circumstances as it has for 2,500 years. That's why Japanese Buddhism looks so different from Tibetan Buddhism, which looks so different from Sri Lankan Buddhism, because it adapted in constructive, helpful ways, and it took on the guise of the host culture. Now we have a guise of modernity. It's global. What works? What is really helping people achieve shamatha, vipassana, on the Mahayana path, the bodhicitta, realization of emptiness, stage regeneration completion, tekchu tutkyel? What's working? So bring in that science, the scientific spirit of empiricism, skepticism, pragmatism, and really making measurements, and bring in the scientists. If there are physiological ways of measuring these kind of things, let's go for it. Behavioral measures, there are behavioral measures of compassion, I think, of altruism, pro-social behavior, bring them in. Let's get it transparent so we see, because this should be treated like medicine. You don't just keep on giving the medicine and say, this is the best medicine, this is pure medicine, and then not notice whether it works or not. I mean, the afflictions of the mind are, in a way, far more serious than the afflictions of the body. You can get a new body, but you can't get a new mind. Right? So in a way, the spirit of empiricism of science could really be a tremendous boon to Buddhism. And then conversely, Buddhism could waken science from the slumber of the last 150 years, in which its imagination has been strangled almost to death by scientific materialism. You know, waken from your slumber, for heaven's sakes. Get over it. So good, you've learned a lot about the objective, physical, quantifiable world. Hello, have you noticed that you no longer belong to the universe? Have you noticed that you have no place in the universe you have envisioned? Because you've attributed everything you do to the brain, and the brain is out there, and you're looking at the universe, and you're looking from the outside in, except for you don't exist. Have you noticed maybe that's a crazy way of looking at the universe? You've conceived of the universe, but you don't have any place in it? And yet the universe is your conception? Have you noticed that this is insane? And maybe you should balance out this radically empirical approach to the study of mind to complement your marvelously empirical approach to studying the objective universe. So maybe Buddhism can save science. The mind science is above all, but with ramifications like a tsunami wave of implications for biology and for physics and for cosmology, right down to the ground. So, if you wanted to be living in boring times, you chose the wrong time. But if you'd like to be part of something quite extraordinary, then for those of us interested in Buddhism, I think it's really time to put up or shut up. And that is, if this is true, if these assertions about shamatha, vipassana, tekchut, and so forth, if this is true, somebody better be taking it seriously. And not just the yogis way back deep in Tibet. Somebody better say, hey, this is a hypothesis I'm willing to invest a whole life into. And if I'm wrong, well, man, that'll be a great adventure anyway. And if I'm right, civilization transforming. But the time is really now. If we think, no, let our children do it, then our children will hear from Tony's successor, you know, my teacher's name was Tony, he's passed away now, but he knew some really great lamas. Well, my teacher was Alan, he had some lamas who knew some really great lamas. How's that going to sell? It's kind of like really some dumb religion that used to be maybe alive, but probably not, because it's probably once upon a time there was something for which there's no empirical evidence whatsoever. Because nobody took it seriously enough to pass it on to the next generation. So I think the stakes are very high for human civilization, for science, for Buddhism, etc. Let's go practice for the day.